What is politics about anyway? Is the title of the talk, Aquinas on the Common Good. George Bernard Shaw is quoted as saying that politics is the last resort for the scoundrels. It's a funny line. We might even think it's true. It's quintessentially Shaw-esque in tone, but its attribution to Shaw, I'm sorry to say, is dubious. The English playwright appears never to have said this. Shaw did say, however, that everyone over 40 is a scoundrel. If that's true, then I should warn you that I joined that club just last week. So watch out. Who knows what I might do or say in my new rascally state. Certain is the attribution of the following line to Boyce Penrose, a contemporary of Shaw and a U.S. senator. Public office, Penrose once said, is the last refuge of the incompetent. That's also a funny line, Shaw-esque in tone. We're left to wonder, however, whether Penrose applied this line to himself or to his colleagues in the Senate only. Both phrases, the dubious one from Shaw and the certain one from Penrose, adapt an older adage coined by Samuel Johnson, the master of English letters. Boswell reports that Dr. Johnson once called patriotism the last refuge of the scoundrel. Dr. Johnson's line isn't so funny. It's less humorous than the other two, for it cuts more deeply than they do. Its implications for the political life are more serious. Even if they were delivered tongue-in-cheek, all three phrases express a certain unease with politics. And more than just unease, it would seem. Each expresses a certain cynicism regarding politics, both in terms of the work itself of politics and of the men and women who undertake political service. Work itself is seen as corrupting, or perhaps simply the refuge of the already corrupt. The implication is that noble souls, honest men and women, should avoid engaging in politics. Their honor, their nobility, their dignity will be tainted if they do. People in every age, of course, have suffered uneasy moments with politics and their political leaders. But this perennial unease seems only recently to have led to cynicism regarding politics. One doesn't detect the same cynicism in medieval authors, for example. Take Dante, a kind of George Bernard Shaw of the 14th century. Dante suffered personally at the hands of his political leaders. They forced him into exile to live far away from his native Florence. In the Divine Comedy, Dante placed several of these leaders, princes and popes alike, in hell. Yet for all of his suffering, Dante did not become soured to the political quality of human life. He remained convinced of the nobility that politics and political leaders naturally possess. As evidence for this reverence, consider Dante's placement of just rulers in the sixth sphere of paradise, above the theologians and philosophers. Thomas Aquinas, too, maintained a reverence for the political task, despite suffering at the hand of political leaders. Aquinas lost a brother during the mid-13th century squabbles between the Pope and the Emperor. Still, Aquinas could write to the King of Cyprus that rulers, quote, bear a special likeness to God, since the ruler does in his kingdom what God does in the world, which is to govern. Consequently, quote, good kings are most pleasing to God and are to be most highly rewarded by him. In the Divine Comedy, Dante adopted Aquinas' teaching on this point. The writings of authors like Dante and Aquinas prompt us to ask why medieval thinking held politics and political leaders in high regard. It's not that medieval rulers were more virtuous than our own, or that medieval men and women were less aware than we of our leaders' weaknesses. For every Louis IX of France, there was a John of England. The subjects were well aware of the virtues of the former and the vices of the latter. What maintained the medieval reverence for politics, despite the inconstancy of their rulers, was, as Aquinas and Dante reveal, the unflagging medieval recognition of the nobility of the common good. Following the classical writers of ancient Greece and Rome, medieval thinkers maintain a high regard for the common good as the better good of individuals than their particular goods. Work for the common good, therefore, was considered better and more important than work for one's own particular good. Or better said, work for one's particular good was itself elevated when it was pursued in conjunction with one's work for the common good. This high regard for the common good was applied directly to the work aimed specifically at pursuing and supporting the common good, politics, as well as to those persons charged with governing the common good, political rulers. For the medievals, both the work and the worker, tied explicitly to the common good, acquired the high dignity and nobility of the common good itself. For the rest of this talk, I would like to examine, so as better to identify, the good that the medievals understood as dignifying politics and political leaders. We speak today a lot about the common good, but very few of us, including our leaders, have a clear sense of what the common good is and why it is to be sought, supported, and revered. As a guide for our examination, we will take Aquinas, a leading intellectual light in his own day who is still esteemed by Catholics as the Church's common doctor. Aquinas never wrote a treatise on the common good, but he described the nobility of this good in several of his writings, including the Summa Theologiae. Like Aristotle, Aquinas deemed the common good as the most divine of earthly goods. Accordingly, he judged the human striving for the common good the most divine of human strivings. Quote, "It certainly belongs to the love that obtains among men, that a man should strive for and preserve the good even of a single individual. But," Aquinas continues, "it remains better and more divine that this love should be shown to the whole nation and to cities." And what follows, I will try to explain what led Aquinas to this conclusion. What did he see in the common good that led him to elevate the common good as the highest of the human person's earthly goods? Before we begin to examine Aquinas' teaching on the common good, let us take a moment to appreciate just how slippery a concept the common good is. Not only politicians today, but also philosophers give wildly different interpretations and descriptions of what the common good is. Even the Catholic Church, which lists the common good as one of the four pillars of its social teaching, struggles to articulate one consistent description. For example, the Compendium of the Social Doctrine of the Church, an official publication of the Church, offers not one but two descriptions of the common good. Though the compendium portrays the two as distinct expressions of a single description, they are in fact different descriptions of the common good drawn from contrasting philosophical traditions. One description is historically modern and highlights the common good's usefulness to individuals. The other description is classical and features the common good's transcendence over other goods. As ambiguously described, the common good is less clarifying of Catholic social teaching than the compendium presents it as being. The concept's two descriptions introduce not lucidity but tension into the Church's doctrine. The modern description finds expression in the Catechism of the Catholic Church, which describes the common good as, quote, the sum total of social conditions which allow people, either as groups or as individuals, to reach their fulfillment more fully and more easily. Word for word, the Catechism reproduces this description from Vatican II's Gaudium et Spes. For their part, the authors of Gaudium et Spes adapted the description that Pope John XXIII had recently introduced into the Church's social lexicon. In his 1961 encyclical Mater et Magistra, written to affirm the mid-20th century culture of progress, the good Pope identified the common good for the first time ever in a magisterial text as, quote, all those social conditions which favor the full development of human personality. The Catechism's definition, therefore, recapitulates a 50-year tradition dating back to John XXIII, within which magisterial teaching describes the common good as a utilitarian good. It is a quantitative sum of conditions instrumental to a person's individual and social thriving. Published a decade after the Catechism, the Compendium of the Social Doctrine of the Church amends the Catechism's quantitative and instrumental view of the common good, though it repeats the Catechism's description, calling it, quote, primary and broadly accepted. The compendium nonetheless adds a classical description of the common good, which sees the good's commonness to derive from the good's unity and transcendence rather than from its division and utility. Quote, the common good does not consist in the simple sum of particular goods of each subject of the social entity. Belonging to everyone and to each person, the common good is and remains common because it is indivisible and because only together is it possible to attain. Thus does the compendium add a second, contrasting description of the common good to the catechism's. Against the catechism's description of the common good as a divisible sum, the compendium describes the common good as a whole, whose indivisible goodness, as transcending the sum of its parts, diffuses itself to the parts as their shared final cause. It is thus that, according to the compendium, the common good belongs at once to everyone, the whole, and to each person, a part of the whole. So to sum up the distinction between the catechism's and the compendium's descriptions of the common good, we can say this. A catechism describes the common good as dividing and distributing its constitutive parts as the particular goods of individual persons, while the compendium describes persons themselves as constituting the parts of the common good, to whom the transcendent goodness of the ordering of the persons themselves diffuses undividedly and commonly. It's not our purpose this evening to settle the problem raised by the dual description of the common good in the Church's official teaching. It suffices to mention that Aquinas' description of the common good aligns more with the classical description of the compendium than with the modern description of the catechism. Let us turn then to Aquinas' description of the common good. In order to describe adequately what a common good is, one has to do two things. First, one has to explain how it is that a common good is a good, and then how it is that a common good is common. Aquinas provides both of these explanations. When Aquinas says that a common good is a good, he means that as a good, a common good is something that human beings desire insofar as they desire their perfection. In other words, a common good, like all goods proper to human beings, provides some measure of perfection to the human creature, some augmentation of his or her being, such that the human creature becomes more human. More of his human nature is actualized for possessing it. So much for Aquinas' explanation of how a common good is a good. That's the easy part in seeking to describe the common good. Now we examine Aquinas' explanation of how a common good is common. And this is more difficult, or at least it's more involved. It's more involved because one has to make several distinctions to arrive finally at the specific type of commonness that renders a common good common. First, Aquinas divides all of the goods that are proper to human beings into two broad categories: particular goods on the one hand, and common goods on the other. Particular goods are goods that diffuse their goodness simply to one person. Thus, a particular good is the good of one person alone. My shirt, my shoes, my idea, my milkshake, my paycheck, my grades, etc., are all examples of particular goods. By being the proper good of one person, particular goods are necessarily alien to all other persons. My shirt is not your shirt. My paycheck is not your paycheck. My grades are not your grades. And vice versa, your shirt is not my shirt. Your paycheck is not my paycheck. Your grades are not my grades. By contrast, common goods are goods that can diffuse their singular goodness to many persons. In other words, a common good is the good of many persons at once. Accordingly, by being the proper good of one person, a common good is not prohibited from being the proper good of another person at the same time. A common good is the good of both. In fact, a common good is the good of all to whom that common good is proper. That is the first distinction that we have to make in order to grasp how it is that a common good is common. A common good is simply not a particular good. A common good is a good shareable by many. But there is more to say. For although we often use the term common good to speak about shareable goods, not every shareable good is a common good, properly speaking. What do we mean by this? How do we tell the difference between a shareable good that only appears to be common and a shareable good that is, in fact, common? The compendium reminds us how. A common good, the compendium says, is an indivisible whole, not a divisible sum. This is the second distinction we have to make in identifying the commonness of common goods. Many of the shareable goods that we call common goods are not indivisible wholes, but are instead divisible sums. And we should be able to tell the difference. An example of a divisible sum that we often call a common good, but really isn't, is a collection of particular goods. A candy jar in a doctor's office, a company's pension fund, a city's water reservoir are examples of a collection of particular goods. We routinely call these collections common goods because, as the source of some pleasure enjoyed by many persons, the collection appears as a good common to its beneficiaries. But we have to be careful. These collections are not common, properly speaking, for they lack the principal distinctive of common goods: a unity, a oneness, a wholeness that diffuses itself universally. Unlike a common good, a collection does not constitute a unity, a oneness, a wholeness capable of diffusing its goodness wholly and universally to its participants. Instead, as an aggregate of goods, a collection of particular goods diffuses its goodness by dividing itself and dispersing the particular goods that it collects to individuals. Thus, what attracts individuals to the candy jar, the pension fund, and the water reservoir is not the jar itself, or the fund itself, or the reservoir itself, as if each of these were a single common good. Rather, what attracts individuals to the jar, the fund, and the pension, the jar, the fund, and the reservoir, are the jar's many pieces of candy, the fund's monthly disbursements, and the reservoir's numerous gallons of water. The jar, the fund, and the reservoir have to be divided in order for their goodness to be enjoyed. Hence, despite our use of the term common good for a collection of particular goods, we should not confuse a divisible sum for an indivisible whole. We should not confuse a collection of particular goods for a common good, properly so called. A common good, properly speaking, therefore, is an indivisible whole and not a divisible sum. Another distinction is in order here, however. In order to understand just what kind of common good the political common good is, we must identify what kind of indivisible whole the political common good is. As Aquinas helps us to see, there are three types of wholes that exist: quantitative wholes, substantial wholes, and wholes of order. As a common good, the political common good is a whole of the last kind, a whole of order. Let us examine briefly each of these three kinds of wholes in order to grasp why the political common good, insofar as it is a whole, can only be a whole of order. The first type of whole is a quantitative whole, or a whole of a simple quantity of something. It is a whole that has no parts, if we can speak that way. Therefore, the division of the whole leads not to a breakdown of the whole into its constitutive parts, it has none, but rather to an increase in individual instances of the original whole, just in smaller sizes. For example, dividing a line results in having more but smaller lines. Similarly, dividing a brick of chocolate results in having more but smaller pieces of chocolate. The metaphysics of quantitative wholes is pretty simple. In a quantitative whole, a substantial form does not function to unite disparate parts into a greater whole. It functions simply to determine what kind of thing a given quantity is. Consequently, when a quantitative whole is divided, its substantial form is itself divided and remains complete in each of the resulting pieces of the original whole. The smaller line remains fully a line, and the smaller piece of chocolate remains fully chocolate. The second type of whole for Aquinas is a substantial whole. Here, substantial form does function as an inner principle binding disparate parts together into a whole. The division of the whole thus leads to the reduction of the whole into its essential parts. Under this category of wholes are located natural and organic wholes, namely living beings, whose substantial form, the soul, functions to confer identity and activity both to the whole, the living body, and to each of its parts, the head, the hands, the eyes, the heart. In substantial wholes, no part retains either its identity or its activity apart from the whole. Aquinas' famous example of the cadaver illustrates this principle. When it loses its soul, a living body is not only no longer a living body, it is no longer a body. What is left becomes a cadaver. The cadaver was a body, of course, but now without its soul, Without its substantial form, the cadaver lacked its former identity, unity, and activity. Formerly quickened by a soul, the cadaver assumes a new substantial form that confers on it and all of its parts a different and lifeless identity, unity, and activity. The third type of whole is a virtual whole, or a whole of order. What makes a whole of order a virtual whole as opposed to a substantial whole is that, within a whole of order, the whole substantial form relates not substantially but only accidentally to the parts. This means something very important for the parts of a whole of order. Each part retains its own identity and activity apart from the identity and activity bestowed on it by the whole. Thus, a whole of order is not a substantial whole, like a human being, a dog, a plant, but rather a virtual whole, like a house or a society of persons. A virtual whole, while it is not a substantial whole, is still a real whole. It's just that its parts do not exist solely to constitute the whole. A doorknob remains a doorknob, whether or not it forms part of a house. So too, a man remains a man, whether or not he becomes the father of a family or a citizen of the city. When Aquinas speaks of the political common good, therefore, he is speaking of the good of a whole of the third type, a whole of order. The political common good is a whole of order that has persons as its parts. Now, when some people hear this, that persons are parts of a greater whole, persons form parts of the political common good, they get nervous. Isn't this the philosophical recipe for the totalitarian oppression of individuals? For Aquinas, no. In fact, he understands the person's relation to the political community in exactly the opposite terms. When Aquinas says that, as, quote, every part is ordained to the whole, as imperfect to perfect, so he says man is, quote, a part of the perfect community, the political community. When he says this, we must remember that Aquinas does not mean that man constitutes part of some substantial organic whole. For Aquinas, a citizen is not like a heart enclosed within the ribcage of a living being, outside of which the heart loses all meaning and purpose. Still less is the citizen part of a quantitative whole. As a part of a whole of order, the rational and free being maintains his proper identity and activity as a rational and free being, with his vocation to supernatural happiness unmolested, for which he finds not the final but nonetheless an important good, a good that perfects him in the common good of the political community. For Aquinas, then, this good is what politics is all about, the common good of the political community, the good of a special whole of order that has persons for its parts, to each of whom, as parts of the whole, the good of the whole belongs as their proper good. This view of the common good has many implications for how we might understand politics and imagine our political life together. It can shape how we understand the purpose of government, as well as the purpose of voting. For example, what are we voting for when we enter the booth? Our particular good or the common good? We'll have to save these questions for another discussion. I'd like to end this evening's talk by examining the reason why Aquinas holds the political common good in great esteem. Remember that he calls the common good divine, as well as one's work for the common good divine. Not literally divine, of course. The city is not God. Thanks be to God. But Aquinas recognizes that the common good has a divine-like quality, which is to say that it imitates the divine goodness of God in a particular way. The key to grasping Aquinas' elevated view of the common good is to understand that what makes one's common good better than one's particular good is not the size of the good. For Aquinas, the common good is not better than the particular good because it is bigger. The common good is better than the particular good because it is greater, ontologically speaking. The first step Aquinas takes towards highlighting the common good's excellence is to note that not all goods, as final causes, diffuse their goodness to the same extent. We've already touched on this theme. Some goods communicate their goodness widely to a number of effects, while others diffuse their goodness narrowly to only a few effects, or even just to one effect. Goods, therefore, naturally rank themselves in a complex hierarchy based on the extent or reach of their self-diffusion. Widely diffusing goods sit above narrowly diffusing goods. To establish this point, Aquinas comments on a text from Aristotle's Metaphysics. It must be acknowledged, Aquinas writes, that the higher a cause is, the more it extends its causality to many. A higher cause thus has its own proper higher effect, which is more common and is found in many things. Aquinas' observation here is a simple syllogism defining the commonness of higher causes. The higher a final cause is, the greater its diffusion. The greater a final cause's diffusion, the greater and more varied are its effects. Consequently, the higher a cause is, the greater and more varied are its effects, or the more common it is. Thus, to climb the scale toward higher causes is to climb toward increasingly common goods. We have to note right away that for Aquinas, the question of how higher causes or goods affect more realities is not a matter, again, of strict quantity. Bigger common goods are not, for reason of their size, higher common goods. For example, according to recent records, the number of enlisted members of the U.S. Armed Forces is double that of the entire population of the Solomon Islands. Does the common good of the U.S. Armed Forces, therefore, rank higher than the common good of the Solomon Islands simply because the former affects more people than the latter? The answer is no. Higher goods are not higher because they extend themselves to a quantifiably larger number of participants. Properly speaking, they are higher because their proper effect extends to more types of lower goods, whose quantifiable size remain beside the point. Aquinas explains, quote, "In the realm of the human arts, the political arts, which sit above the military arts, extend themselves to the entire realm of the community. The military arts, however, extend themselves only to those things contained within the realm of the military." For Aquinas, the political community stands above the military community because the political community extends itself more widely. It covers a broader range of lower goods than does the military community. In point of fact, the military community is one of the effects to which the political common good extends. The military good is thus enfolded, in a sense, within the political good. For this reason, the common good of any political community, regardless of its size, always remains higher than the common good of any military force. Accordingly, it would be proper for the U.S. Armed Forces to act generously and jeopardize its good for the good of the Solomon Islands. By the same token, it would be improper for the Solomon Islands to jeopardize its good for the sake of the good of the U.S. Armed Forces. Once Aquinas highlights the proper ordering of higher and lower causes, He makes a practical observation. Because higher causes extend themselves more widely than lower ones, they demand a higher love, a more noble love from their participants. Aquinas makes this claim when commenting on Aristotle's assertion in the Ethics that statesmanship ranks highest among the practical sciences. And this is the quote here that you have on your handout. Let's just read through it together. It is clear that every cause, Aquinas writes, inasmuch as it is stronger and more important, extends itself to many proper effects. This is repeating what we've already said, that the higher one moves up the hierarchy of goods, the stronger the good becomes, which is to say, the more widely it diffuses its goodness. Therefore, the good, which carries the note of final cause, and inasmuch as it is stronger and more important, extends itself to many effects. Thus, if the same end were the good of one man and of the whole city, it would seem better by far and more perfect to undertake, that is, either to procure or to save and preserve, that which is the good of the whole city, than that which is the good of one man. Now, certainly it belongs to the love that obtains among men that a man should strive for and preserve the good even of a single individual. But it remains better and more divine that this love should be shown to the whole nation and to the cities. That is to say, while indeed love should be shown to only one city, by far it remains more divine to share this love with the whole nation, in which many cities are contained. Aristotle calls more divine that which relates more to the likeness of God, who is the universal cause of all good. In this passage, Aquinas distinguishes common goods from particular goods as one would distinguish higher goods from lower goods. There are many interesting things we could point out in Aquinas' reasoning here, but let us focus on just one, which centers on the relation of one's particular good to his common good. Notice what Aquinas describes here regarding the love of friends in relation to the common good. Aquinas assuages the fear that some might have of one's pursuit of the common good suppressing one's pursuit of his particular good. Specifically, he defends the integrity of particular goods from the supposed menace of common goods by recalling the essential role that particular goods play in friendship. Certainly, Aquinas writes in the quotation above, it belongs to the love that obtains among men, friendship, that a man should strive for and preserve the good of even a single individual. Friends seek the goods of their friends as if they were one's own. To refute the suspicion, then, that higher goods somehow eclipse lower ones, Aquinas points to how friends naturally pursue each other's particular good, the good even of a single individual, he says, as a requirement of their mutual love. A friend would fail in friendship if he did not desire and pursue the other's good, including the other's particular good, as his very own. Thus, as evidence contrary to any supposed antagonism between higher and lower goods, Aquinas recalls how friendship of its essence trades in particular goods, the higher call of higher goods notwithstanding. Friends do no violence to the common good when they lovingly supply the particular goods that each wants or needs. Aquinas is quick to note, however, that the mutual pursuit of particular goods does not exhaust the love of friendship. A person seeks the whole good of his friend, which includes the friend's particular as well as his common goods. And it is here that Aquinas finds that the primacy of the common good reveals itself. While Aquinas says that, quote, it belongs to the love that obtains among men that a man should strive for and preserve the good of even a single individual, he completes the thought by adding, quote, it remains better and more divine that this love should be shown to the whole nation and to cities. In other words, it remains better and more divine when the love aimed at preserving and sustaining a friend's particular good is aimed at preserving and sustaining his common good, first and foremost. Contrary to the modern reader's worry, therefore, Aquinas' doctrine of the common good does not preclude the pursuit of either one's own or one's friend's particular good. He merely notes in both respects the greater worth of pursuing the higher good. Aquinas' argument here in the Ethics commentary rests on what he sees as determining the greater worth of higher goods. This worth results not from the subjective will of the good's participants. We don't choose it, or our choosing doesn't create it, but from the objective makeup of the good itself. For Aquinas, higher goods are of their very nature more attractive. They exercise a stronger pull due to the greater density of their goodness. The thicker a good is ontologically, the farther its finality extends in diffusion of its abundant goodness. Goods are thus better, more attractive, more expansive, the more flush they are with objective goodness. Accordingly, participants owe higher goods a care and an attention commensurate with their exceptional quality. All things being equal, therefore, higher goods deserve more love and attention than lower goods. It is with regard to the ontological worth of higher goods and the commensurate love that they demand that Aquinas adopts the language of Aristotle and calls the love of higher goods more divine. He concludes the passage we have been examining. Aristotle calls more divine that which relates more to the likeness of God, who is the universal cause of all good. Aquinas observes something godlike in created goods that transcend their singularity and extend their goodness to many effects. He sees something godlike, too, in the rational creature who transcends his singularity and loves a common good commonly. When we apply Aquinas' reverence for common goods in general to the particular good, then we can see why, for Aquinas, there is no need, no room even for cynicism when considering the political common good or considering the work necessary to achieve the political common good or to regard cynically those who dedicate their lives to pursuing the common good. It's not politics, then, for Aquinas, that corrupts the noble. It's certainly not the political common good that corrupts the noble, but rather loving the political common good incorrectly, for oneself and not for itself. That's the problem. That's where we should direct our cynicism. Worse still is ignoring the common good altogether. To do so is to deprive ourselves of a divine-like good, of a good that is the highest among our earthly common goods, a good designed by providence itself to give us both a share and a foretaste of the divine communion of heaven. It's a high vocation for politics and the political common good. But Aquinas deems it, reveres it, because he sees in it God's preparation for the human race to share his divine communion in glory. I'll leave the discussion there for the moment. No doubt, certain things brought up in the discussion spark questions, comments, corrections even, and certainly take a few minutes to entertain those now. Thank you for your attention. Thanks again. For the invitation, and yes, I'm happy to entertain.
Well, Gimbel, when you said that it would be an ennobling vision, I think everyone in the room heard you and heard you very clearly that there was no room there in Thomas, that golden moment for Dominicans, in the view of politics. And you would be one of the very first to know in this room, as a Dominican, that after the death of Thomas, you have nominalism and you have voluntarism coming up. And to put it very shortly, put the question for you, whether we're looking at Machiavelli or Thomas Hobbes, or all the way up to this campus recently with John Rawls and the notion of choosing from behind the veil of ignorance. Mm-hmm. You had said that the common good is not better than the particular good precisely because it's not bigger, rather it's better because it's greater,
right.
So that there is a higher good that diffuses itself. It is more noble, we should choose that. But in our modern society, the reason why your language may sound ennobling and yet somewhat distant is that...
There's no question that it's that, yeah. The Dominican would be the first to admit that.
Doused with this notion of nominalism and this notion of voluntarism.
Right.
Society is a convenient fiction. All that really counts are individuals. And what counts for the individuals is choice. Choice is a huge word in our politics. So my question to you, and it is admittedly a tough question, given 800 years of nominalism and voluntarism all the way from the immediate successors of Thomas through John Rawls, is there a project going forward, perhaps with the Dominicans, where you say, if we're going to turn our politics around, we first have to turn around how people understand what it means to be an individual in society, what it means to choose in the whole.
Right. 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 I mean, there has been some... reflection on this. So the Thomist philosopher on whom I focused for my doctoral work, Charles de Koninck, who taught at Laval in Canada from the 30s to his death in 65. He was a philosopher of science, which that was his specialty, but on the side wrote on morals and politics. And one of his little works, the one I focused on for the dissertation, is called The Primacy of the Common Good. And he wrote that specifically to begin to combat the very problem you bring up, because de Koninck began to see in the 30s and 40s that this idea was beginning to affect the way that even Catholic philosophers were beginning to talk about the human person, the dignity of the human person, human happiness. Where do we locate kind of the principles of all of that? And what he saw particularly in the personalist school, the French personalist school, especially among the Catholics who were participating in that, and it was becoming very influential in Europe, North America, was that they made a trade, you know, in regard to the tradition. Whereas for somebody like Aristotle, Aquinas, and that the classical tradition located the principles that ennoble the human person outside of the human person. So let's say in the good of the family, in the common good, being a part of the universe, having God, you know, as their end and goal. These are the things that ennoble man, that perfect his freedom. The personalists made a trade-off. They decided to go modern, in a sense, to locate the principles of his dignity interiorly, so basically in freedom and in choice. And so de Koninck puts pen to paper in that moment to try to reel his friends back in saying that, yes, we need to talk about dignity. Dignity is the banner under which, you know, we need to fight against totalitarian oppression. But let's not make, you know, according from de Koninck's point of view, the modern turn where we turn a blind eye
you know, to the goods, the hierarchy of goods that exists outside of us that determine us to a certain extent, and try to locate, you know, all of those principles of dignity within the individual. So he was one person, and lots of folks opposed him. So there was an interesting debate that took place at that time. But I think there are some. I think, I mean, within the Catholic world, at least, there are people who are beginning to be interested in this question. You know, when you look at, and among Thomists, when you look at the history of Thomism here in the United States, the Thomist, the journal, which is, you know, comes out of the faculty at which I teach, that began in 1939, for the first 15 years or so, up until the mid-50s, in every issue, there was at least one article dealing with politics of the social question, or what was called the social question. But in about 55, that disappeared. And it never really revived. You don't see, you know, great interest. I mean, at least in the Catholic world, interests turned to other things. I mean, the cusp of the council, things became pretty intramural at that point. There was not, I would say, the same kind of looking out, especially at the civic questions, political questions, and dealing with them, at least to the same degree. Or maybe that was just among Thomists. But the Thomist journal itself kind of tracks this. So there was, in the mid-20th century, interest. So I think, I mean, one of the things I'm trying to do on the faculty where I teach in Washington is to help the younger Dominicans. You know, some do. They come in. I mean, very interested in these questions. And so we're all kind of trying to find together who and what and when, what were they saying, and try to rebuild things.
So thank you, Jane.
Thank you for your talk, Father. I had a technical question.
Sure.
Regarding the relationship between the individual's good and the positive.
Right.
Is the individual's good only properly actualized when the common good is actualized, or is the realization of the common good contingent upon the realization of everyone else's individual good?
It would depend on the circumstances, because we can imagine situations that fit both your descriptions. I mean, obviously, people live. I mean, they'll eat, they'll clothe themselves, they'll have families. You know, when their political common good has been destroyed. I mean, the Syrian refugee, for example, you know, can still, you know, still seeks his or her, you know, particular goods, sustains the life of their family, even though they're in exile or still in their homes. You know, the apparatus of the political common good has collapsed. And at the same time, I mean, you can, I mean, there's, one can, because of the relationship of the common good to the particular good, risk one's particular good for the preservation of the common good. So, I mean, this is the policeman, the fireman, you know, the soldier, or even the politician, I mean, who can, you know, give up, I mean, certain pleasures in the world, certain successes, particular successes, career and things like that, for public service. And we see those things as a noble thing to do. I think a better way to see it is that, at least for Aquinas, he doesn't separate the seeking of these two goods into two separate moments, as if there are times of the day when I'm only seeking my particular good, and there are times in the day when I'm seeking the common good. There's much more overlap, which is to say that by nature, each of us belongs to a family, you know, and by nature, each of us belongs to a political community. So at every moment that I'm seeking even my particular good, it's still as a member of a family, as a citizen of a city or a nation. So I don't leave those behind when I seek the particular good. And that's what's one of the marvelous things about the common good of the family, is that you see in a very intense way the coordinated pursuit among family members of their particular goods together around a common hearth. You know, so that they pursue their particular goods in the home together. And that's not to deny. You know, I think in the family, then, we see better than, say, in the city, how the pursuit of the two goods go together, or overlap.
Thank you.
I mean, you've given us this very, very illuminating discussion of the common good, and it is certainly worthwhile to understand these distinctions and the ways it's used in the different goods. But it is still a good. It is still something that is created, and one of the things about Aquinas is that he always was very clear about both how the goods are properly used and how they're properly misused they're misused.
They do have their proper misuses. Yeah.
and so I'm wondering if there, and just thinking about my knowledge of politics both now and historically, it seems that most of the time when politics is misused, it's not, strictly speaking, the common good that's misused.
Mm-hmm.
It's people ignoring the common good and focusing on their particular goods, whether you want to call it rent-seeking or to use another buzzword or popular buzzword or something else.
Mm-hmm.
So is there a way in which the common good can be misused when it's still the common good?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right.
What should we watch out for?
Yeah. Well, this is what, I mean, I didn't put it in the talk, but St. Thomas has a wonderful reflection on tyranny. And what does he mean by tyranny, or how does he identify or describe tyranny? The tyrannical person, he's thinking particularly of the ruler, is the one who loves, I kind of alluded to it in the talk, who loves the common good not for itself but for himself. Which is to say that he treats the common good and the things of the common good and even his authority over the common good as if it were his own particular good, you know, for his own self-preservation, for his own self-aggrandizement. What he's failing to do there is failing to love the common good as it's to be loved, as for itself, as a higher good. The tyrant doesn't allow him or herself. It doesn't allow the common good to draw out of him or herself the higher good that the common good demands. Rather, he remains fixed at a lower love, or he tries to embrace the higher common good with a love that's proper to a lower good. That's how he sees, you know, tyranny. Now, we have other descriptions of tyranny. I mean, you can look at it historically, you know, even quantitatively, you know, the horrible things that tyrants do. But why do they do these things? It's because they're loving properly speaking, the common good improperly. I think we can expand that. And that's what de Coninck wanted to do, and he did this in his writing on the common good. He wanted to expand that not just to the ruler, but also just to individuals, that especially after the democratic turn of the late 18th, 19th century, there's something that each individual now bears for the sustenance of the common good, especially in those democracies that are self-governing, that it's not just the ruler now who is charged to exercise regnative prudence, as Aquinas says, a particular prudence, you know, for the preservation of the common good, but that's shared by everyone now. And so I think there's a lot of work that can be done, a lot of thinking that can be given to the democratic individual, especially in the act of voting. What is happening there? How is that an act of sovereignty that Aquinas, 8 centuries ago, would have seen just exercised by the ruler? How, after the democratic turn, is that now democratized? And what does that mean now for the prudence of individuals in terms of the common good? Do individuals only seek to preserve the common good for themselves? Or when they go into the voting booth, when they advocate, are they thinking about the preservation of the common good as a whole? Are they loving the common good as the common good? Are they loving it commonly to be shared with others? Or do we just go into the voting booth for our own particular interests and hope that, you know, 51% of other individuals are going to vote the same way? So I think I think there's some overlap in how it is that, the misuse of the common good, so to speak, is tied into this excessive love, you know, of our particular goods.
Thank you for your time.
Yeah.
I have a bit of a two-pronged question.
Okay.
That hopefully doesn't get too complex. But I'm wondering if understanding, so grounded on truth, is in itself a common good.
Mm-hmm.
And then on the other side, is misunderstanding a common evil? And I have in mind our understanding of fertility.
Mm-hmm.
In society today, where beforehand the proper understanding is it's a gift and it's part of good health, and the misunderstanding today is it's an obstacle to sex and recreation, and it's given us this contraceptive mentality where now a child is a disaster and we rather abort it and get rid of it because it's messing up our misunderstanding of fertility.
Right. There, I didn't get into the paper here, but there is a treatment of there are different types of goods that we call common goods that aren't quite, you know, they don't quite match up to being this unitive whole of order. I only specified collections of particular goods, but abstractions like truth, health, and those things too. We commonly speak of them as common goods, and that's not wrong. Just like it's not wrong to call like the candy jar the common good of the patients in the doctor's office. It's just that for Aquinas, he just wants us to be careful, to be aware of what we're doing when we use that language, that we're using it analogously in those senses, that the prime analogate for the common good properly speaking, is this whole of order, this good of a unity that diffuses itself widely to all of its participants, to all of its parts. So that would require a conversation. Okay, well, what is truth? What do we mean by truth? And how is that an abstraction? Because there's no good out there truth that's diffusing. You know, it's because what we have when we know truth, it's the mind becomes adequated to reality, that, you know, the reality is out that's outside of us is represented intellectually adequately inside of us. That's truth. Now, the thing is that I can only do that for myself, you know. You can only do it for yourself. Now, the thing is, we might have knowledge about the same thing. And in that way, we can talk about truth or knowledge being common. But what's really happening there? Well, there's your act of, you know, the mind's adequation to reality, mine. And it just happens to be focused on the same thing. That's not quite kind of a whole of order. You see what I'm saying? So there's a way in which we talk analogously about truth as a common good, health as a common good. But again, Aquinas would just say, let's kind of sift through the weeds there and just help ourselves understand, are we speaking analogously or properly in that moment? Yeah. And that analogous attribution is not wrong for Aquinas. It's just recognizing a reality there, that there's some likeness there, but at the same time there's a greater unlikeness, and we just need to be aware of what that is, so we don't conflate, you know, that everything we call a common good is a common good in the same way.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
And with that, let's thank Father Gilmore.
Thank you very much.